Welcome to Kicking It with Raphael. I'm Mark Serber, filling in for Mr. Geller, who has taken a very well-deserved vacation. And while he was gone, I will be joined by Zach Goldman, who, if you haven't heard of him before, you will very soon. Zach is a fellow Yank, but somehow the communications manager at Oxford and also a writer for the Shin Guardian. And by the end of the show, you will be following him on Twitter at ThatDamnYank. We have an awesome show for you today, as Zach and I will start with the Gold Cup. We will then hear from Fox Soccer's Keith Costigan about Liverpool, the Suarez saga, and preparations for the new season. And finally, we'll talk to the Washington Post columnist and soccer insider Stephen Goff, who will enlighten us about the new events unfolding in D.C. regarding a possible soccer-specific stadium on the banks of the Anacostia River. But first, Zach, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining me on Kicking It with Raphael. And the first question I have for you is, which players in your mind from the USA made a case to make it to JK's roster for the upcoming qualifiers and possibly for a spot on the plane to Brazil?
Well, it's a great question, Mark. First of all, thank you so much for having me along. It's my debut podcast in any form, so please be gentle. But no, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. As for, stock changing during the Gold Cup, I think it's really great question. I think everyone, you know, wants to win the tournament. Everyone wants to get the shot at potentially going to the Confederations Cup, the next one, in 2017. But I think that really is, in some ways, the primary focus for this tournament in terms of getting people reps who maybe we haven't seen before, putting people in new spots. We have a tremendously versatile pool, which is something that we haven't had the benefit of having in the past. And I think playing players in certain positions, getting them more familiar with their new roles as we head into next summer was tremendously crucial. In terms of players who I think raised their stock, honestly, like there were quite a few. I think even starting in goal, you can make the argument that both Nick Raimondo and Sean Johnson both had fantastic tournaments. Nick Raimondo sort of has the Tony Meola role, I think, written all over him. I think he will be the third goalkeeper that we see in Brazil. But Sean Johnson certainly made people forget about the U23's fiasco. Had an absolutely stellar game in this tournament. That save against Costa Rica was just out of this world good, and definitely preserved the victory for the Yanks as they marched through the tournament. I think the big focus for me in a lot of ways was in the midfield. You had players like Kyle Beckerman, who I think we've all seen quite a bit of. You can make the argument that perhaps he's underappreciated by the U.S. fan base. I think sort of the populist view of him as a player is that he tends to, you know, make the safe pass, make the easy pass, but that's in many ways what this team needed in this tournament. I think his role changes potentially as we go forward into qualifying, and then looking at potentially how he could be utilized next summer in Brazil, it becomes a little bit of a different discussion if he can sort of have the efficacy that he has here in this tournament, in that one against better competition. I think it's up for debate, certainly, but the stats don't lie, and he was definitely a big part of the success. It was sad to see Stuart Holden go down, but I think he certainly put his name in the hat, as he always does. Now we'll see with that ACL tear how soon he'll get back, but it's really great to see him back in the colors. And Mix Discarude, obviously, is a massively popular figure, not just for his hair, but also for his flair. And I think he's a guy who you'll see going forward being tried in new spots, potentially a little bit further up the pitch to balance out his potential defensive frailties as we're exposed at times during this tournament, but definitely put his name in the hat here. I mean, you look all over the roster and there were pluses and minuses. I think Bedoya and Shea were the two players that I saw flickers of good stuff from. Certainly Bedoya had some fantastic moments. He had his two assists, obviously. Shea had his two goals, but both certainly drifted in and out of the games, but I think we'll still be in the discussion as we move closer to the World Cup. Obviously, Landon Donovan winning Golden Ball is the number one positive coming back into the tournament. The person who we were all looking to see if he could recapture old form, the halcyon days of LD, and he was certainly back and in a big way, not just with some glittering individual work, but he really was the pulse of this team, despite what the armband might say. And on that note, DeMarcus Beasley had a great tournament. I maybe haven't been his biggest fan over the years, but certainly has had not only a tremendous career, but also a tremendous last, you know, 3 or 4 months, really filling in well into that left back role. I think it's difficult to gauge how long term of a fit that'll be based on this tournament. He's definitely impressed against CONCACAF opposition, given this team another dimension going forward. Can he do this against, you know, the Italys and the Brazils of the world? I'm not too sure, but certainly I think Beasley's definitely part of this team's plans as it goes into Brazil. I think Eddie Johnson did himself a lot of favors, and then all across the back line, you saw positives with Michael Parkhurst, I would argue, really did himself a lot of favors. And even Clarence Goodson, who, you know, maybe he's not the quality defender of a Matt Beisler, but he certainly showed well today, showed well in the past month, and really displayed how he's on a different level physically than a lot of the players in this region. Whether or not that translates into international success on a more prominent stage, I'm not sure. But, you know, he definitely wasn't the Rose Bowl fiasco of last Gold Cup. He showed very well.
And going up top, I mean, first of all, we didn't get to see too much of Hercules Gomez, but we know what he can do. I feel he's a versatile player because he can play through the middle, but he can also play from that wing position. Is he somebody that you see in Jurgen Klinsmann's plans? And obviously, Wondolowski scored a ton of goals, but you have to look at the teams that he scored against, and you have to ask, is he really a forward that's capable of playing at that international level going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think one of the interesting spanners that's being thrown into the works is the fact that, you know, with yesterday's announcement of Aaron Johansson deciding to play for the U.S., if he becomes a member of that very suddenly deep forward pool, how that changes Jurgen's priorities in terms of how he wants to fill out this roster up top. I think someone like Hercules gives you a lot. He's someone, as you point out, who's tremendously versatile in terms of his forward play. One of the better players on the roster, I think, in terms of making himself available for not maybe the final pass, but the second to last pass. He's one of those players who always finds a way to get in a scoring position, as of course someone like Chris Wondolowski is famous for. But you can make the argument that he's also capable of showing well in the midfield, dropping back and getting combination play going, really kind of showing in good angles and maintaining possession. And you know, he adds a lot of verve going forward in a way that maybe someone like Chris Wondolowski doesn't, just by virtue of playing style. And I think going forward, Hercules, unfortunately, maybe isn't on the depth chart where he was a year ago, and through no fault of his own, but rather because other people have come into the mix, and also because this team has decidedly played in a very different style in the last 12 months that maybe doesn't make use of Hercules' strengths as it did in the past. But nevertheless, he's going to remain part of the discussion, and I think so much of it is going to come down to the pre-World Cup camp. I think both Wando and Herc are probably going to be in that camp, and it'll come down to club form, it'll come down to friendlies, and we'll see what happens. But I mean, every cycle there's someone like a Connor Casey or a Steve Ralston or someone who does something really tremendous in the last two or three qualifiers who doesn't make it to the World Cup, and it might be one of them, but we'll have to see. I mean, I think you bring up great points in terms of both of them being in the discussion and offering different things, and it'll be up to Jurgen to see which fits best with the 23.
And speaking of different things, I feel like one of the things about Jurgen Klinsmann is at least I have always preached that you needed patience. Klinsmann trying to bring in kind of a radical style, a new way of playing that the team had never been used to before in terms of that high pressure, working hard for 90 minutes. But over this 11-game winning streak, the thing that I've seen not only come to fruition for Klinsmann is his plans and everything that he's been trying to put into place, but it's also the fact that they've been able to win games in different ways. When they were playing a Honduras side in the World Cup qualifiers that really condensed the field, they fought through and were able to get that one goal, but they were still trying to play through three very packed banks of lines. Then in this tournament, when they play Honduras again, they completely stretched them out. And I think they did the same thing for the most part against Panama. So now, Are you seeing a Jurgen Klinsmann team that is not only starting to play the way that Jurgen Klinsmann wants them to play, but they also are starting to have plan Bs and plan Cs about playing against teams that are coming at them with different kind of strategies? Is this something that we're seeing from Klinsmann?
Absolutely. I think it's a fantastic point. I mean, it's a tournament where a lot of players improve their stock individually, you know, some marginally, some taking half steps backwards as they take a half or a full step forward. But as a team, it was a tremendously positive step forward, and for exactly the reasons why you mentioned. I mean, I think in this tournament, there wasn't a lot of pressure on us through the midfield as there might be in some of the qualifiers or in future World Cup games. But the team's great at playing in several different shapes and facing a variety of different pressures. And by shapes, I don't just mean formations. I mean the fact that we're making adjustments on the fly. We're deciding to have, you know, imbalanced shape in the midfield, in defense. This team's getting incredibly good at finding out where our weaknesses are and diagnosing them on the fly. You know, Bob Bradley's a great manager. I loved him. I loved having him. But his teams were often thrown for a loop when we were facing certain teams, particularly ones that outnumbered or outworked us in the midfield or pressured high. I mean, Spain in the Confederations Cup is probably an obvious rebuttal to that, but there are a host of reasons why that day was different. But I think that overall we saw that team's downfall was not staying in games 90% mentally and not being in touch with itself in terms of seeing how our shape affected our style of not only playing with the ball, but playing without it. And now you have something where Klinsmann has taught this team, you know, whether it's Klinsmann or whether it's the players he's put on the field, but I happen to think it's Klinsmann's touch tactically, is that, you know, this team has become tremendous at making adjustments on the fly, possessing the ball, creating meaningful chances whilst not, you know, getting beat on the break and really not sacrificing defense for attack. I think meaningful possession is a huge part of it. The fact that we're in, and this goes back to what we were saying earlier about Kyle Beckerman, is that you have players who keep the ball moving, who are making off ball runs. But then you have those that stay home who, you know, so having midfield anchors is a big part of this team, in keeping shape consistent and responsible in the midfield, tracking deep lying runs, doing things like that are, you know, deeply responsible, that are difficult to maybe pick up on first watch or are difficult to pick up when you're just watching through the lens of a TV camera. But we're doing it, and it's showing through how responsible we've been on the defensive end of things. And that's not something that I saw with Bob Bradley's group of players, and that's pretty evident by our performances on the biggest stage. I mean, you look at the first few games of the Confederations Cup in 2009, you look at our performances in the first 10 minutes against England, against Slovenia, you look at, you know, after the opening whistle and the first whistle of extra time against Ghana, those teams just weren't prepared to rip up their plans, throw them out the window, and then start from scratch a few minutes into the game. And this team is, and you can see it. You saw it against Panama. I mean, a lot of people derided the game for being boring, and I can understand that from a viewership angle. But if you're a fan of this team, you have to be excited about the fact that this team was very patient. They were very responsible and astute, and they responded to what they were seeing on the pitch. And they really waited to break down those doors. And once we got the goal, I didn't see any way for Panama back in it. So I thought it was the perfect cherry on top of a tournament that shows that whether it's the Gold Cup roster or the A team, this team, you know, knows its strengths and weaknesses well. And some of those weaknesses are things like set pieces. I mean, it's important to know that that's something that we have to work on. But from the run of play, this team's as good as I've seen a U.S. team play, you know, since I've been alive, which I think is, you know, maybe a big statement, but I don't think it's hyperbolic at all.
No, definitely not. I think it's definitely one of the most attractive teams we've seen play. And like you say, a team that has that plan A, plan B, and plan C, that they're able to switch those plans in the middle of the game, which has made them so dynamic. The one thing that comes to mind now is the idea that, was there any players from that A team, from the team that won those matches against Germany and then went on to win those three qualifiers, who were given a rest during this CONCACAF Gold Cup and thinking, oh man, the player that's playing in the Gold Cup might be taking my position? Is there anybody from that A team who now has to be worried that their spot might be in danger after seeing the work of their colleagues in the Gold Cup itself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think everyone, you know, it would have been a different story maybe if we didn't have a good qualifying run. But I think, as you point out, like all the players who played in that stretch did quite well. I'm not sure that anyone is in danger of getting replaced necessarily. I think the only one that comes to mind right now is that Omar Gonzalez might have a little bit of a problem, you know, inserting himself as a first choice center back. But I think we all knew that going into the tournament based on prior performances. I mean, you can make the argument that someone like Kyle Beckerman's knocking on the door, but I don't think we're ever going to see him start in a major qualifier maybe in a major qualifier, but not as we get closer to the World Cup. You know, I think everyone is really curious about this DeMarcus Beasley situation, because even though Bees started in quite a few matches in that stretch, you kind of wonder, you see the team sheet getting a bit crowded, and you wonder where someone like Fabian Johnson fits in. I mean, obviously the first choice, I think, in everyone's mind is to have Fabian further up the pitch. But as Landon comes back into the fray, that's adding another indispensable person to the 11. And it'll be a really interesting carousel to see how the Graham Zusi, Landon Donovan, Fabian Johnson wide options work. And if Fabian's the odd man out there, the logical choice is to move him to left back. But then the question becomes, you know, who would you rather have? Would you rather have DeMarcus Beasley, or would you rather have a Fabian Johnson? They offer you very different things. And I think a lot of it's contingent upon who's available at right back. Because one of the things that the U.S. has gotten so good at is it's pressuring high with one outside back as they leave the other at home. And it's a little bit difficult to see, you know, if anyone gets left out in that situation. But I would suspect that Fabian Johnson has a little bit to worry about. But certainly, I think the players who are watching this in Europe or watching this at home, who are in the A team, were really excited to see how deep this team is, because it is the deepest pool we've ever had by far, I'd say. But what about you? I mean, do you think that anyone's getting a little bit antsy, a little bit nervous?
Well, I think, you know, Zusi, obviously. So, okay, Landon Donovan's back to his best. That's going to be a problem for me. I think Beckerman has shown in the middle, you know, maybe Mauricio Du has some worries, but I think that you pretty much, you know, nailed it right on the head in terms of the players that you have to think about. DeMarcus Beasley certainly came in and filled in and did a job, with Fabian Johnson perhaps dropping back to accommodate the likes of Landon Donovan. It'd be tough to see Beasley fitting in. However, once again, we talk about that depth, and what's interesting to me is a year ago we were all decrying the fact that the U.S. had no depth whatsoever. So this all kind of came out of nowhere, it seems like, and all of a sudden we have two proper teams where a year ago we were worried about putting 11 strong players onto the field. So I think that's something that's really been huge for U.S. soccer over the last year, and I think a lot of it is just, you know, kudos to the people who have patience in Klinsmann and who stuck together through that thick and thin, and now they're starting to see his work and his vision starting to kind of come to fruition a little bit. And it's just something you hope continues, because these things go in cycles, and the U.S.'s next few games could be disastrous. You just don't know what's going to happen. So, but for now, you just got to enjoy the 11-game winning streak.
Absolutely. And I mean, looking at the other side of the coin, I mean, imagine Mexico 12 months ago, and look where those fans are now. I mean, it's, you know, I know a lot of people, even when they were successful, weren't big fans of Chepo, but I think it's this pretty next level what they've experienced. Something that's interesting, I mean, I'm a massive Klinsmann fanboy, and I don't think I've ever hidden that. Maybe a lot of times against the well-reasoned logic of a lot of the fan base who were losing patience with him. I mean, I really didn't have any good concrete reasons for why they needed to stick with him other than sort of blind faith in his project. But I think one of the things that I was pretty sure was going to be a positive for the team was the fact that we were playing so many different lineups. I mean, the fact that there wasn't consistency was a major positive for me, because we'd seen such consistency for Bob Bradley for long stretches. And not just maybe in terms of personnel, but in terms of how we, you know, how we played in certain matches. I think there was an air of conservatism with this team for long stretches, that there wasn't really with Klinsmann. Even in games where we weren't scoring goals, we weren't taking shots, we weren't even possessing the ball, there was a feeling that we were always in matches and we were always trying things and we were always experimenting. And that's really what you have to do early in a cycle. It really makes you wonder what would happen if, I mean, complete revisionist history, that never would have happened. But, you know, if Bob Bradley steps down after that World Cup and you get Klinsmann a year earlier, you wonder who gets discovered. You wonder, you know, what inroads you could make with some of those German players who are waiting in the wings maybe for not as long and get acquainted with the U.S. system a bit earlier. But, I mean, I think the big thing is that now the focus changes. Now we're, you know, going to be 10 months from a World Cup. You have a few crucial qualifiers, but we're in a very good position. And I think now the watchword becomes consistency. And we need to make sure that it's about building some familiarity with an 11 and with an 18 and then with a 23 as we move closer to the World Cup. And especially the defense needs reps together. I mean, this defense, we've seen a lot of faces move in and out. And for me, the thing that I'm most worried about more than anything is that we've had kind of a carousel of center backs, and we need to make inroads into finding a priority pair there and putting two people together that we can put our faith in. But that'll come. I mean, I think you're totally right. Like, there's a lot of people who were not so hot on Klinsmann last year, and I think it's unanimously considered that he was the right choice at this point, and that what he's doing, for better or for worse, is working, and it's something we'll stick with. So, I mean, I think we'll continue to see new players get involved, but hopefully, you know, the slope will start to level out a bit, and, you know, it'll be one or two new players per roster, or one or two kind of underdog picks, so to speak, and then we'll sort of solidify the core around it.
Well, 11 games and counting, not a bad way to celebrate 100 years of U.S. soccer. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. You are our host here, and as many times that you are available coming to us from first Oxford and then London to where you'll be moving to, you are always a part of this show as the host. And unfortunately, you weren't able to stick around for the interviews, which are coming up with Keith Costigan talking about Liverpool and Stephen Goff. But we'd like to say thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to meeting up with you again next week as our co-host here on Kicking It with Rafael. Well, Rafael is on vacation, and we are both, of course, very jealous of Rafael Geller, but we're also very happy to be taking over his show for him while he takes his break. So, Zach, thank you so much. Good luck with your move from Oxford to London, and next time that we speak with you, we'll be speaking with you from London, and greatly look forward to it.
And likewise. Thanks so much, Mark. Thanks for putting up with me. Really appreciate it. And thanks to Rafael for having me on. And good luck with everything.
And once again, you can read his articles on the Shin Guardian, follow him at Oxford, where he is the communications manager, and follow him on Twitter at ThatDamnYank. He already has way too many more Twitter followers than I do, but it's certainly well-deserved. So, Zach, we will talk to you next week around this same time.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
All right, man. Take care. So that was my co-host, Zach Goldman of the Shin Guardian, who will be with us again next week. Unfortunately, he wasn't available last night as I got a chance to talk with Fox Soccer's Keith Costigan about Liverpool Football Club and all the preseason buzz that's surrounding Luis Suarez and co. at Anfield. So on the line right now, we have with us from Fox Soccer, Keith Costigan. And Keith, obviously, your bread and butter is Liverpool. And so first of all, there's the talks of Arsenal and a couple of other clubs who are chasing Luis Suarez. What is Liverpool's stance on Suarez right now? And do you see him staying or do you see him going?
It's a delicate situation because I think nowadays players seem to have a lot more power to force these kind of rules. I think it's obvious everybody knows that Luis Suarez wants to play in Champions League, but from my understanding, from what I've been told, Liverpool's stance is they won't sell him below what they believe this is value. And I think that goes even double for selling him to the club that they would consider a big rival for finishing in the top four, and that would be Arsenal.
And what is the value that they might be willing to consider letting him go for?
Well, the figure anybody I've spoken to, close to Liverpool, hasn't given an exact figure, but you get the sense that a bit of 50 million would be a figure that would make Liverpool think long and hard about trying to A, be there. And then B, what you can do with that money to kind of bolster the squad and make up for the losses for it. But I think ultimately, though, it should be said, Brendan Rodgers and Ian Ayre, they're of the mind that they don't want to sell Billy Suarez.
And obviously, this goes without saying, the club has protected him through everything the last 2 years, and it seems to me that they're still willing to protect him no matter what happens, no matter what he goes through. So that doesn't seem to be a consideration at all as to whether or not they're going to let him go.
I mean, the club is going to love for Billy Suarez because he has put them in some awkward situations. I would say, even going back to Kenny, that he should have really protected him and maybe to the detriment of his own job at the club. So, but again, I've heard a lot of players or a lot of fans saying maybe Luis Suarez owes Liverpool. You know, in the modern day, players don't work like that, and clubs don't work like that to players either. If Luis Suarez wasn't scoring goals on a regular basis and wasn't one of the top players in world football, maybe Liverpool wouldn't have survived as much as they did when he was involved in the racist allegations, whatever, and obviously the fighting incident with Ivanovic. So, but, you know, in answering your question, I don't think that plays a part in whether they sell him or not. The issue is that Brendan Rodgers sees him as a vital part of Liverpool finishing in the top four, and because of that, they want to keep.
Well, obviously, Suarez is definitely a big part of the puzzle. Let's sink our teeth into something else right now and talk about Pepe Reina. Obviously, he's gone to Napoli. He said he felt forced out. What do you think really happened, and is this the right move for Liverpool as a club?
Well, first of all, I think Pepe Reina was a great servant to Liverpool. He played, he was one of the top performers for his first couple of seasons there, but I definitely felt his form dipped over the last 2 years. And that may be a case of the whole team's form dipped over the last 2 years, but I don't think Pepe Reina is the goalkeeper he was a year ago. But having said that, he is only 30. I think as a goalkeeper, his best years should still be ahead of him. I actually believe this is the best move for both of us. I think it will re-energize Pepe Reina, and I think it's a good move for Liverpool. I don't necessarily think he was moved out because he had told Liverpool he wanted to go to Barcelona. So Liverpool has to make moves. If that happens, they brought in Manile, he's a very good young goalkeeper. I think to give him the full support, Liverpool have to back him as number one. I don't think it was in Pepe Reina's best interest to stay as a number two. And I'm not buying that Pepe Reina didn't know anything about this move because in his book he said Rafa Benitez called him every day for 6 months before signing for Liverpool. The manager in Napoli is Rafa Benitez. I'm guessing they had a couple of conversations.
And especially in this 24-hour-a-day circus media, especially during what we call the crazy season with all the transfers, players, unless they keep themselves away from the paper, they have to know what's going on one way or another. Speaking of which, who are Liverpool's current transfer targets? Are there any players that they're trying to bring in? And are there also players that they might be trying to get off their wage bill at the moment?
Central defender, and I always absolutely butcher his name. Papadopoulos, maybe, I believe, from Bundesliga. He's been a target for an awfully long time. I don't think that deal is any closer to being done. It's also moved a little bit to the back burner, given that I believe Rodgers and his coaching staff are being happy with the way Colin Torrey has played, and look, goodness, why didn't he arrive at the club? The other target that I've heard a lot is Christian Eriksen, but I've been told by people closer to the club that right now he isn't on the radar, although that could change given the fact that Alisson had missed out on the person who was the number one target, and that was Henrik Mkhitaryan, who eventually went to Borussia Dortmund.
Now you look at a player like Christian Eriksen, don't you think he should be playing Champions League football?
That may be one of the issues, but again, you look at Christian Eriksen of maybe 2 seasons ago, and there seems to be a lot more interest in him as a player than there is now. So I think Christian Eriksen's career is small, and the price tag on him tells you that. The level of interest and the clubs that are interested tells you that. I believe that if Liverpool went with a firm offer, they would be in with a real opportunity of securing his services. I'm just not sure he is high on the list as of right now. But again, there's plenty of time left in the transfer window, and I'm sure Liverpool will build up different targets over the coming weeks.
And do you get the feeling that this is kind of going to be like other transfer targets where agents, players, and teams themselves are going to wait till the very end so that they can play their best hand and try and get either cut rates for their players or the most money that they can get for their agents?
Unfortunately, it happens.
I think for me, I'm just hoping to see Odemwingie drive somewhere else and sit outside a parking lot, but I don't think that will happen. Getting back to Liverpool, where do you see them finishing this season, and who needs to have a big season for the club? Is this going to be a season where they're depending on Raheem Sterling to break out, or is he still too young, and what do they expect from Daniel Sturridge? What would be a good goal range for him in order to help fire Liverpool into the top four?
Well, I think there's twofold. You're talking about a Liverpool team with Suarez and without Suarez. And with Suarez, I think you look at the top three and say Manchester City, Chelsea, and Manchester United should be beyond the rest. I do think there's going to be a betting in period for David Moyes, but I still think ultimately those are the top three teams in the Premier League. Then, behind that, you're looking at Arsenal, Liverpool, Tottenham, and Everton. Again, Everton continues to finish in the top eight, but again, it's going to be a transition period with Roberto Martinez. So that brings you to Arsenal, Liverpool, and Tottenham. Now, if Tottenham lose Gareth Bale, take Gareth Bale out of the team last year, Liverpool all of a sudden in contention to finish higher than Tottenham Hotspur. And if they manage to hold on to Luis Suarez and manage to stop Arsenal getting Luis Suarez, they have every chance of finishing above them. So best-case scenario for Liverpool, I think, is our fourth position. And I think with the squad they have now, and if other dominoes fell in their favour, by that I mean Gareth Bale leaving, and Arsenal not really bringing in anybody, I think Liverpool should expect to fight for that fourth position. And, getting up there, I think Raheem is a great young player, but there's another young player that I've watched for a long time, going back with Liverpool Academy, where I spent a lot of time, and that's Jordan Ibay. And Jordan Ibay is arguably a better all-round footballer than Raheem Sterling. He's not a finishing touch. He can be a goal-scoring threat. So Sterling will improve this year, but watch out for Jordan Ibay as well. He's going to have a good year, too.
All right, well, you heard it here first from Keith Costigan. And Keith, first of all, what's your Twitter handle?
I'm Keith Costigan.
And we know you obviously got stuff going on, the Chivas USA Academy, and also upcoming matches on Fox Soccer. What will you be doing with Fox Soccer so we know when to tune in?
Well, we're delighted, obviously, to be covering the ICC, the Guinness Cup. This week on Wednesday night, we'll be having the first game in North America between Juventus and Everton, coming from AT&T Park, which I don't know too much about baseball, but I do know it's an historic baseball stadium, so looking forward to that. Then this weekend we'll be bringing a couple of games: Real Madrid, Juventus, Everton, LA Galaxy, all from Dodger Stadium. And then next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll be bringing you the final 2 days from Sun Life Stadium in Miami. So, watch out for tournament again. For me, there's no such thing as friendly games. Now, these players are playing for their spots in the lineup for next season, and of course, so many new coaches: Jose Mourinho back in Chelsea, Ancelotti at Real Madrid. All of these coaches looking to get off to a positive start with their team, so it's going to be a fun tournament to work on and a fun tournament to watch.
Well, I got one final question for you, Keith, and that is, do you need somebody to carry your bags for you while you jet set to all these places?
If I'm the busiest, you're the second busiest, so there's no way anyone could afford going on this time either. So maybe soon enough we'll work together.
Well, you know, that's, you know, one thing I was going to say to end this segment is that, you know, I have done games at Fox Soccer, but I truly feel that I know that I'll have made it when I do get to do a game alongside you as the analyst. So that's something that I'm personally working toward in the future. Keith, thank you so much for joining us. Have a safe trip, and we can't wait to listen to you on Fox Soccer during these matches, and all the best.
All right, let's play tomorrow. Thanks. Anytime, buddy.
And that was Keith Costigan, who has spent a lot of time at Liverpool's youth setup. Part of it while he was in Europe getting his UEFA A coaching license, and he is one of the best analysts in the business, so you'll definitely want to catch him when he is on Fox Soccer. Well, it's time to switch it back to this side of the pond, where possibly exciting news coming from DC United. Will they finally get a stadium? The best person to ask is DC soccer expert Stephen Goff.
So we're honored to be joined now by Stephen Goff here on Kicking It with Raphael. And Mr. Goff, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time. And obviously, we want to talk to you about the prospect of a new stadium in D.C., but we have to ask you first, what has gone wrong with D.C. United this season?
It's been a rough season in every way. From the disappointment of star player performances to travel mistakes during games, injuries, to everything. Everything you can think of has gone wrong for the team, and it has manifested itself into a miserable season, one that's probably not going to get much better the rest of the year. They're just trying to pull everything into the U.S. Open Cup and try to rebuild and regroup for next year.
And how much of this is down to the team itself and the bad luck that you mentioned and injuries, and but how much blame should be pinned on Ben Olsen here?
You know, there's a lot to blame. Olsen has a role in the roster selection at the beginning of the year. So he and Dave Casper built this team. But for the most part, this is the team that made it to the Eastern Conference Finals last year. Certainly they let some players go and he made a few changes, but to see such a dramatic drop-off was rather shocking. They weren't as good as a conference finalist you would think a conference finalist would be. They probably exceeded their expectations last fall. Maybe got a little complacent in the offseason, didn't make any major, didn't add anyone of significance during the offseason. And that seems to have cost them. The issues with two defensive players, central backs, make a lot of money, not to mention the problem of faltering time and again. The backbone of your team is in trouble. So, certainly partly to blame, but,
a lot of issues here. Well, unfortunate for DC United. Hopefully, from a United perspective, they can turn things around and maybe salvage their season, although not really looking that way at the moment. But on to the possibility of good news for DC United. After 10 years of searching, plans finally seem to be in the works for a possible 20,000 to 25,000 seater stadium at Buzzard Point. For our listeners, just tell them where that is exactly in the District of Columbia and what it would mean to have a stadium, not only for DC United, to have a soccer-specific stadium, but a stadium in that area.
Buzzard Point is where the Anacostia and Potomac Rivers meet, about four blocks from Nationals Park Baseball Stadium. It's in the kind of a no-man's land industrial area. Very close to the capital, a mile from downtown. It's just kind of a forgotten neighborhood. Not many people actually live there. There's a few businesses. It's a strange little part of town, but certainly with great potential and great location. So it makes a lot of sense. It would keep the team in the hub of the metropolitan area, which is important because their supporters come from Virginia, from Maryland, from the city itself, and if you end up building outside the city, then you're really driving some of your fans away from other jurisdictions. That's important. Will it lead
Budweiser in the area, sure, you know, I suppose. I mean, the city ultimately wants to link the entire waterfront together. The baseball stadium is part of it. The Navy Yard is another piece. And then a little farther to the west, the Main Avenue and the arena stage and the marina area. So this area would kind of connect it all. Certainly be a boost to the city. It wouldn't just be for DC United. It would be for, you know, concerts, international soccer matches, college soccer, lacrosse. There's a lot of things you can put in an inside stadium as we've seen around the league.
And as somebody who's growing up in D.C., if you know the waterfront, like you said, the like arena stage, there's some gorgeous areas right next to not gorgeous areas. So for them to be able to link it up would be a huge deal in D.C. and would be great for the city. But as you pretty much know, growing up and being a part of Washington, D.C., as well as every much in the U.S. knows right now, things don't always get done if they ever do in Washington. But before we get into the possible pitfalls, why was Jason Levine and Eric Thorer, the managing partners of D.C. United, so much quicker at being able to reach a plan with Mayor Vincent Cine Gray for D.C. United's backroom staff that hasn't really been able to do that in the past?
Well, to begin with, they have the money. This group joined Will Chang in the investment team last summer, and they brought with it not only some political sway because of Levine's experience in Washington, but a giant pile of cash. And that comes from Eric Thohir, the Indonesian businessman who's making a run at Air Milan ownership. You know, his family is a billion. And, you know, when Levine brought him into the fray, to join Will Chang, suddenly this team had the money to build a stadium on its own. Previously, you know, the team was looking for the city to become a partner in this. And the city just really couldn't afford that. Washington had some stadium fatigue from the baseball park episode in which, you know, taxpayer money went to building the stadium. So, you know, it all starts with the money. And then it was up to Jason and his team, the legal team, to work with the city and find a compromise and find a deal. Also, in the big picture, the economic climate of the country is much improved. You know, you weren't going to get anything built years ago. It would have been very, very difficult in the city. Now, the city has a surplus, a budget surplus, and a little more flexibility in purchasing the land needed for the stadium and helping with the infrastructure. So, everything's changed now that the new ownership is in place.
And at the same time, how much of this do you think has to do with the fact that Mayor Vincent C. Gray is up for re-election coming up pretty soon?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, politics, of course, are going to play a big role in this. There are members of the city council who will undoubtedly fight the proposal, in part because it will make the city look good. And there are council members running for mayor. So, you know, politics, of course, comes into it. Gray is all for it, and administration is for it, but they will need the city council to pass certain issues allowing the stadium to be built.
And so getting back to the original question is, what are the possible stumbling blocks on the road to building this stadium? Because the original document that was presented to the media, it wasn't very detailed, but it also seemed to have a lot of statements that it looked like there could be a lot of contentious issues either with the city or the residents that could cause a lot of debate and put this idea right back on the back burner and start that fighting up again that we're so used to in Washington on so many levels.
This is a political fight, for sure. And the city council will decide, you know, do they want to participate in this very complicated land swap that would allow the property at Buzzer Point for stadium use? There's a lot of moving parts here. not going to be easy. So we'll see. You know, this thing isn't going to, they're not going to break ground tomorrow. It's not going to open anytime soon. I mean, they're looking at least a couple of years remaining at RFK. And best case scenario, they could be in early 2016. Realistically, you know, if everything goes well, you'd be thinking maybe middle of 2016, start of 2017, we'll see.
And I think this question is actually more for me than for the listeners, so I apologize to everybody out there, but can you explain to me the land swap deals that would need to happen in order for this stadium to become a reality?
What's that?
Can you explain the land swap deals that would need to happen in order for this stadium to become a reality?
Well, the Anchorage developers own much of the land at Buzzard Point. They would give up a piece of that in exchange for prime property that the government owns in downtown Washington. Property that, if you want, that the government owns, the offices that are there would move into a new building in Ward 8 in Anacostia. Happens to be one of Mayor Marion Barry's ward, so that smoothens the pot for him. He's been happy. So there's a lot of things would have to shift around, and the city council would have to weigh whether the value of the land that they're giving up to Anchorage development in downtown is worth it. They got to decide whether the tax situation would work for everyone to fall. And they would have to approve the construction of this new building in Anacostia. So it's not cut and dry. There's a lot of gray areas here. And we've got a long way to go. Hopefully everything's in place by the end of the calendar year.
And so knowing that there's all these gray areas, the fact that you've lived in the D.C. area, you know the political climate, you've been hearing about this new stadium idea, we all have been for over a decade. How skeptical or convinced are you that this stadium is in fact going to happen?
I think it's probably going to happen. I think it makes sense in a lot of ways. It's a complicated deal, but I think they can pull it off. I don't think it's going to happen on a quick timetable by any means, but I think my hunch would be that it would happen. Could things go wrong? Absolutely. Are there political issues? Yes. Are there financial issues? Of course. There's so many things that can go wrong here. That's why people are a little nervous. You know, fans are a little skeptical. The team is kind of careful with what they say. This press conference last week was not their idea. This was the city's idea. They wanted to present something positive, and they decided to make the announcement. But as far as the team is concerned, they'd rather not say a word about it until they're shoveled in the ground.
Well, it makes certain sense, especially the way things are going for DC United. I think that they don't really want to announce anything positive until positive things are actually happening on the field. But, Stephen,
yeah, that's even gone before. You know, they had a press conference in Prince George's County in Maryland a few years back. That petered out. There was a lot of talk about Poplar Point in the city on the Anacostia River. That never materialized. So, you know, they're trying to keep things quiet and work the back channel, work the back room to get this done. They've made a lot of progress. They're getting close. But it's certainly not an official deal yet. And that's what obviously will keep people up at night for several months to come.
Well, for DC United fans, certainly the support that they've given the club from the very beginning and through thick and thin, I think this is something, and this is something as I'm saying as a D.C. native, and some of you know, I think that this is something that they greatly deserve. But we want to say, you know, knowing that your columns appear daily in the Washington Post, and that your blog is seemingly updated every few seconds, we know how busy you are. So we want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today on Kicking It with Rafael, and we really appreciate it having you on.
My pleasure, Mark.
So that was Stephen Goff, and you can follow him on Twitter at Soccer Insider. Also read his columns in the Washington Post and on his blog at washingtonpost.com/blogs/soccer-insider. Insider. And that will do it for our first episode of Kicking It With, or I guess you could say Kicking It Without Raphael. He'll continue his vacation, but Zach Goldman and I, Mark Serber, will be back with you next week. Until then, all the best, and thanks for tuning in.